neck eased down, rather like a dog's hackles smoothing themselves as its aggression subsides. The arch of her neck softened, and then she lifted her eyes, and I felt her piercing gaze. Tintaglia spoke, and her words were clear to all, her question an accusation.
"What do you know of the Pale Folk and their servants?"
I drew breath and spoke clearly, willing that all the dragons and gathered folk would hear. "I know the servants stole my child. I know that they destroyed her. I know that I will seek them out and kill as many of them as I can before they destroy me." My heart had begun to race. I clenched my teeth and then added, "What more need I know?" Both Hebe and Tintaglia became very still. Again, I sensed a flow of communication between them. I wondered if the other dragons or any of the elderlings were privy to what they said. General Rapscal pushed his way through the crowd. He was dressed very simply, in leggings and a leather shirt, and his hands were dirty, as if he'd abruptly broken away from some task.
"Hebe!"
he cried at the sight of her, and then stood still. He looked around at the gathered elderlings and dragons, saw me, and hastened to my side. As he came, he drew his sheath knife. I reached for my own, and was startled when Lent shoved me aside and back, and stepped between Rapscal and me. Unmindful of Lent's bristling, Rapscal called to me.
"Hebe summoned me to protect you. I come to your aid."
Lent gaped at him. I knew a moment of shock and then anger as Purr inserted himself into the situation.
"Behind me,"
I snapped at the boy, and he replied,
"Your back, sir. Yes, I will guard your back."
It wasn't what I had meant, but it moved him away from Rapskull's blade.
"I don't understand,"
I growled at Rapscal, and he shook his head in shared bewilderment.
"Nor do I. I was mining for memories when Hebe summoned me urgently to protect you here, and then she vanished from my awareness as if she was slain. It terrified me, but here I am to do her will. I will protect you or die."
"Enough of your chittering."
Tintaglia did not roar at us, but the force of the thought attached to her words near stunned me. Hebe kept her watchful stance between the immense blue dragon and me, but it was little shelter. Tintaglia towered over her, and she could easily have spat acid at me if she had chosen to. Instead, she cocked her head and focused her gaze on me. I felt the full impact of her presence as her huge spinning eyes fixed on me. My walls could not deflect completely the wash of dragon glamour that surged over me.
"I choose to allow the changes you have made. I will not kill you."
As I basked in that bit of good news, and my guardians hastily sheathed their blades, she tilted her great head, leaned close, and breathed deep of me.
"I do not know the dragon who has marked you. Later, perhaps, he will answer to me for your willfulness. For now, you need not fear me."
I was dizzied with gratitude and awe at her magnificence. It took every scrap of will I could muster to lift my voice.
"I strove only to help those who needed my help, those neglected by their dragons or changed, but not guided in their changes."
She opened her jaws wide, and for a heart-stopping moment I saw teeth longer than swords and the gleaming yellow and red of the poison sacs in her throat. She spoke to me again.
"Do not press me, little man. Be content that I have not killed you."
Hebe lifted then, her front paws leaving the ground, so that she was slightly taller than she had been before. Again, I felt the force of an unheard communication. Tintaglia sneered at her, a lifting of lips that bared her teeth. but she said to me,
"You and those like you may interfere with the ones claimed by no dragons. This I grant to you, for they are nothing to me. Change them all you like, but leave to me what is mine. This is a boon I grant you, because you and yours were of service to me in the past. But do not presume to think I pay a debt to you."
I had almost forgotten Motley on my shoulder. I do not think a crow can whisper, but in a low, hoarse voice I heard,
"Be wise."
"Of course not," I hastily agreed. Time to move away from my ill-considered remark. I took a breath, realized that I was about to say a worse thing, and said it anyway. "I would ask a second boon from you." Again, she made a display of teeth and poison sacks.
"Not dying today?"
Motley said, and lifted from my shoulder. My protectors cowered against me, but did not flee. I counted that as courage.
"Is not your life enough of a boon? Flee," the dragon demanded. "What more could you possibly ask of me?"
"I ask for knowledge. The servants of the Whites sought to end not just Icefire, but all dragons forever when they sought his death. I wish to know if they have acted against dragons before, and if they did, I wish to know why. More than anything else, I wish to know anything that dragons know that can help me bring an end to the servants." Tintaglia drew back her immense head on her long neck. Stillness held. Then Hebe said, in a child's timorous voice,
"She doesn't remember. None of us remember, except me. Sometimes."
"Oh, Hebe, you spoke!"
Rapscal whispered proudly. Then Tintaglia gave forth a wordless roar, and it horrified me to see Hebe crouch and cower. Rapscal drew his sheath knife again and stepped in front of his dragon, waving the blade at Tintaglia. I had never seen a stupider or more courageous act.
"Rapscal, no!"
an elderling cried. But he did not halt. Yet if Tintaglia noticed this act of insane defiance, she gave it no heed. She put her attention back on me. Her trumpeting was a low rumble that shook my lungs. Her anger and frustration rode with her words.
"This is knowledge I should have, but I do not. I go to seek it, not as a boon to you, human, but to wring from Icefire what he should have shared with us long ago, rather than mocking us for a history we cannot know, for no dragon can recall what happened when one is in the egg or swimming as a serpent."
She turned away from us, not caring that humans and elderlings alike had to scatter to avoid the long slash of her tail as she did so.
"I go to drink. I need silver. When I have drunk, I shall be groomed. All should be in readiness for that."
"It shall be,"
Fron called after her as she stalked majestically away. He turned back to his parents, and his elderling cheeks were as pink as their scaling would permit.
"She's magnificent,"
he shouted aloud, and a roar of both laughter and agreement echoed his sentiment. I did not share the crowd's exultation. I felt as if my guts were trembling now that I had leisure to consider how close I'd come to dying. And for what? I knew no more of the servants than I had before. I could hope I'd won Tintaglia's acceptance for any skill healers that Nettle and Dutiful might eventually send. I could hope that Dutiful might win an alliance with folk who occasionally could modify a dragon's behavior. But I knew Icefire lived. My small hope was that Tintaglia would share whatever she discovered with me. I suspected a long vendetta between dragons and the servants. Could elderlings have been unaware of such enmity? I doubted it, and yet we had not discovered any evidence of it. Or did we? I thought back to the pale woman's occupation of Aslivyal. Illistor, the fool had named her, the ice-encased elderling city had proven a formidable fortress for her, an excellent site from which to oversee the out-islander war against the six duchies, and where she would torment the ice-trapped dragon and attempt to destroy him and his kind. She had done all she could to degrade the city. Art had been defaced or destroyed, libraries of skill blocks tumbled into hopeless disorder. Did not that speak of a deep-rooted hatred? Had she sought to destroy all traces of a people and culture? I did not expect the support of the dragons against the servants. Icefire had had years to retaliate against the servants, if the dragon had harbored any desire to do so. I suspected he had vented all his fury when he had collapsed the icy hall at Aslevyol and put an end to the forces of the pale woman. He had left it up to me to make sure of her death, and that of the stone dragon she and Keeble Rawbred had forged. Perhaps the black drake was not as fierce a creature as Tintaglia seemed to be. It's not uncommon for the female creatures to be far more savage than the males.
Truly?
Per asked, and I realized I'd said the words aloud. Truly, Lanth replied for me, and I wondered if he was recalling his stepmother's attempt on his life. In the open square before us, Rapskull was fussing over Hebe as if she were a beloved lapdog, while Malta, Rain, and Fron were caught in a lively discussion that almost looked like a quarrel. I was ambushed by a wave of vertigo. "I'd like to go back to our chambers," I said quietly, and found no strength to resist Lant taking my arm. The weakness I'd felt after the skill healings I'd done assailed me again, for no reason I could deduce. Amber and Spark joined us as I maneuvered my way up the stairs. Amber stopped the rest of them at the door.
"I will talk to you later,"
she announced and ushered them out. Lant dumped me in a chair at the table. I heard him close the door gently behind himself. I'd already lowered my head onto my crossed arms when the fool spoke to me.
"Are you ill?"
I shook my head without lifting it. Weak, as if exhausted by skilling. I don't know why. I gave an unwilling laugh. Perhaps last night's brandy hasn't worn off. He set his hands gently to my shoulders and kneaded the muscles there.
"Tintaglia gave off a powerful aura of glamour. I was transfixed by it, and terrified at the fury she generated towards you. So strange to feel, but be unable to see. I knew she was going to kill you, and I was helpless. Yet I heard you. You stood firm before it."
I had my walls up. I thought I was going to die. We gained a small bit of knowledge, though. Icefire is alive. His hands on my shoulders felt good, but reminded me too sharply of Molly. I shrugged free of his touch, and he wordlessly moved to take a chair at the table beside me.
"You could have died today," he explained. He shook his head. "I don't know what I'd do. You all but dared her to kill you. Do you want to die?"
"Yes," I admitted it. "But not yet," I added. "Not until I've put a lot of other people in the ground. I need weapons, fool. An assassin's best weapons are information, and more information." I sighed. "I don't know if Icefire knows anything useful, nor do I know if he would share it with Tintaglia, or how he would receive the information if he did. Fool, I have never felt so unprepared for a task."
"The same for me, but I have never felt so determined to see it through."
I sat up a bit straighter and leaned one elbow on the table. I touched his gloved hand. "Are you still angry at me?"
"No."
"Then?"
"Yes. You made me think about things I don't want to remember.
I need you to remember those things for me. He turned his face away from me, but did not pull his hand back. I waited.
Ask me,
he commanded me harshly. So, time to torture my friend. What did I most need to know? Is there anyone within Clarez who might help us? Anyone who would conspire with? Is there a way to send them a message that we are coming? Silence. Was he going to balk now? I knew the brandy ploy would not work again.
No,
he grated out at last.
There's no way to send a message. Prilkop might still be alive. They separated us when they began their torture. I assume he endured much the same treatment I did. If he lives, he is most likely a prisoner still. I think they found him too valuable to kill, but I could be wrong.
I know you doubt the ones who helped you escape, but you and Prilkop sent out messengers. Were they loyal to you? Do any of those folk remain in Clarez? He shook his head. His face was still turned away from me.
We were able to do that in the first few years we were at Clarez, after we had become uneasy with the Four, but before they realized we didn't trust them. We sent them first to warn you that the Four might seek to do you harm. While we were doing that, the Four kept trying to win us to their way of thinking. Perhaps they truly thought that their collators and manipulators would make us believe we had erred.
He smiled wryly.
Instead, it went the other way. I think they found our tales exciting, for they knew little of life outside the walls. As we told them more of life outside their sequestered world, some began to question what the servants had taught them. I do not think that at first the Four realized how much influence we had begun to wield.
Collators? Manipulators? He snorted in disgust.
Fancy titles. Collators classify the dreams and find connections and threads. Manipulators try to find people or upcoming events that are most vulnerable to making the future change in ways that benefit the Four and their servants. They were the ones who worked so hard to convince Prilkop and me that we were wrong. About everything, but especially in claiming that one of my catalysts had fulfilled the dream prophecies of the unexpected son. They were the ones who told us of the dreams of a new white prophet, born in the wild, as they said. The dreams of that child correlated with the dreams of the unexpected son in ways that could not be denied, even by me. They spoke of a dream of a child who bore the heart of a wolf. You asked if you are not the unexpected son, then how can I be sure that all we did, all we changed, was the right course for the world? That was the very question they battered me with, and I saw it crack Prilkop's confidence. In the days that followed, we discussed it privately. I always insisted that you were the one. But then he would ask, and rightfully, yet what of these new dreams? And I had no answer to that.
He swallowed.
No answer at all. And one night, in wine and fellowship, our little friends whispered to us that the wild-born child must be found and controlled before he could cause any harm to the course of the world. They knew that the Four were intent on finding this child. Not all the Four believed the new prophet was the unexpected son, but one did. Symph. Whenever we dined with the Four, she would challenge me, and her challenges were so strong they shook even my belief. Day after day, the Four commanded that the Library of Dreams be combed so that the child could be found and controlled. I began to fear that they would find the same clues I had found and followed all those years ago to find you. So I sent the other messengers, the ones that asked you to find the unexpected son, for they had convinced me there was a wild-born white prophet. And there they were correct. They knew B existed long before I did. And Dwalia convinced them that the child they sensed was the unexpected son.
His words chilled me. They had sensed that B existed. I pulled his words to pieces in my mind, needed to understand fully everything he was telling me. What did they mean by wild-born? His shoulders heaved. I waited.
The Clarys that Pril Cop remembered,
he began, and then choked to a stop. Do you want a cup of tea? I offered.
No.
He gripped my hand suddenly, tightly. Then he asked,
Is any brandy left?
I'll see. I found the corked bottle half under a pillow. There was some left. Not much, but some. I found his teacup, filled it, and set it down on the table. His bared hand crept toward it. He lifted it and drank. When I resumed my seat, I noticed that his gloved hand was where I had left it. I took it in mine. Pril Cop's Clarys?
It was a library. All the history of the whites, all the dreams that had ever been recorded, carefully organized and analyzed in the writings of others. It was a place for historians and linguists. All white prophets were wild-born in his time. People would recognize that their child was peculiar, and they would take the child to Clarys, or the child would grow and know that he or she must make that journey. There, the white prophet for that time would have access to all the older dreams and histories of other white prophets. They were educated and sheltered, fed and clothed and prepared. And when the white prophet felt he was ready to begin his work in the world, he was given supplies, money, a mount, travel clothes, weapons, pens and papers, and sent on his way as Pril Cop was. And the servants who stayed on at Clarys would record all they knew of the prophet, and they and their descendants would patiently await the next one.
He drank again.
There was no four, only servants, people waiting to serve.
A long silence. I ventured, but Clarys was not like that for you. He shook his head, slowly at first and then wildly.
No, not at all like that. After my parents had left me there, I was astonished to find that I was not unique to that place at all. They took me in, kindly and gently at first, to a row of little cottages in a pretty garden with a grape arbor and a fountain, and in the little cottage they brought me to, I met three other children, all nearly as pale as I was. But they were all half-brothers, and they had been born there in Clarys, bred and born there, for the servants were no longer serving the white prophet, but themselves. They had collected children, for they could trace the lineage of each white prophet. A cousin, a great-nephew, a grandchild rumored to be descended from a white prophet, gather them up, house them together, and breed them like rabbits. Breed them back again to one another. Sooner or later, the rare trait surfaces. You've seen Burrick do it. What works with horses and dogs works with people as well. Instead of waiting for a wild-born white to appear, they made their own and harvested their dreams, and the servants who once believed that white prophets were born to set the world on a better path, forgot that duty, and began to care only for enriching themselves and their own comfort. Their true path is a conspiracy to enable whatever brings to them the most wealth and power. Their homebred whites did as they were told, in small ways, put a different man on the throne of a neighboring kingdom, warehouse wool, and never warn anyone of the coming plague that will kill all of their sheep. Until finally, perhaps, they decided to rid the world of dragons and elderlings.
He drank the rest of the brandy in his cup and set it down with a clack on the table. He turned his face to me at last. Tears had eroded Amber's careful powder and paint. The black that lined her eyes had become dark trails down his cheeks.
"Enough, Fitz,"
he said with finality. "Fool, I need to know.
Enough for today."
His groping hand found the brandy bottle. For a blind man, he did a passable job of emptying the dregs of the bottle into his cup.
"I know I must speak to you of these things,"
he said hoarsely,
"and I will, at my pace."
He shook his head.
"Such a mess I made of it, the White Prophet, and here I am, blind and broken, dragging you into it again, our last effort to change the world."
I whispered the words to myself. "I don't do this for the world. I do it for myself." Quietly, I rose and left him the table and the brandy. In the 2 days before the Tarman left the village and crossed the river to us, I saw no more of Tintaglia. Lant had heard that the blue dragon had drunk deeply of silver, made a kill and ate it, slept, and been groomed by her elderlings in the steaming dragon baths. Then she had drunk silver again and left. Whether she had gone to hunt or departed to find ice fire, no one knew. I surrendered my hope that I would learn anything from her. The fool lived up to his word. On the table in my room, he built a map of the island and the town and castle of Clarys. I hoarded plates and cutlery and napkins from our meals, and the fool's groping fingers moved walls of spoons and arranged plate towers. From this peculiar representation, I sketched Clarys. The outer fortifications were presided over by 4 stout towers, each topped with an immense skull-shaped dome. Lamps burned in the skull eyes at night. Skilled archers walked the crenellated walls of the outer keep always. Within the high white walls of the keep, a secondary wall surrounded gracious gardens, the cottages that housed the whites, and a strong house of white stone and bone. The strong house had 4 towers, each taller and narrower than the watchtowers of the outer walls. We dragged a bedside table into the main room, and on this we created a map of the main floor of the servant's stronghold.
"The strong house has 4 levels above the ground, and 2 below,"
the fool informed me as he formed the walls from scarves and arranged towers of teacups.
"That is not counting the majestic towers where the 4 abide. Those towers are taller than the watchtowers on the outer walls. The roof of the stronghouse is flat. On it are the old harem quarters from the days when Clarys was a palace as well as a castle. Those quarters are used to confine the more important prisoners. The towers offer an excellent view of the castle island and the harbor and the hills beyond the town. It is a very old structure, Fitz. I do not think anyone knows how the towers were built so narrow and yet expand at the top into such grand rooms."
"Shaped like mushrooms?" I asked as I tried to visualize.
"Like exquisitely graceful mushrooms, perhaps."
And he almost smiled. "How narrow are the stems of those mushrooms?" I asked him. He considered.
"At the base, as wide as the great hall at Buckkeep Castle, but as one ascends, they narrow to half that size."
I nodded to myself, well pleased at that image. "And that is where each of the 4 sleeps at night? In a tower room?"
"For the most part, Felody, it is well known, has appetites for flesh that he satisfies in several locations. Capra almost always in her tower room. Symphian Coultry, most nights, I imagine. Fitz, it has been many years since I was privy to their lives and habits."
Castle Clarys stood on an island of white rock, alone. From the castle's outer walls to the steep edges of the island, there was only flat, stony earth that any invader must cross to reach the walls. A watch was kept over the water and the narrow causeway. The causeway opened twice a day at the low tides to permit servants to come and go and to admit the pilgrims who came to discover their futures.
Once pilgrims cross the causeway and enter the walls, they see the stronghouse with the vine of time in bas-relief on its front. All the grandest rooms are on the ground floor. The audience chambers, the ballroom, the feasting room, all paneled in white wood. A few of the teaching rooms are there, but most of them are on the second floor. The young whites are taught, and their dreams harvested. On that floor are extravagant chambers where wealthy patrons may take their ease and sip wine and listen as collators read selected scrolls to them and lingstras interpret them for a fat fee.
And the lingstras and collators are all whites?
Most have a trace of white heritage. Born on Clares, they are raised to be servants of the four. They also serve the whites who can dream, in much the same way a tick drops on a dog. They suck off dreams and ideas and express them as possible futures to the rich fools who come to consult with them.
So, they are charlatans?
No, he said in a low voice. That is the worst part, Fitz. The rich buy knowledge of the future to make themselves even richer. The lingstras gather dreams of a drought to come and counsel a man to hoard grain to sell to his starving neighbors. Pestilence and plague can make a family wealthy if they expect it. The four no longer think of putting the world on a better course, but only of profiting from disasters and windfalls.
He drew a deep breath.
On the third floor is the treasured hoard of the servants. There are six chambers of scroll collections. Some of the scrolls are old beyond the reckoning, and new dreams are penned and added daily. Only the wealthiest can afford to stroll here. Sometimes a wealthy priest of Saar may be admitted to study independently, but only if there is wealth and influence to be gained. Finally, on the fourth floor are the living quarters for the servants who are high in the four's favor. Some guards live there, the most trusted ones, who protect entry to each of the four's private towers. And the most prolific white dreamers are housed on that level, where the four may easily descend from their grand towers to have congress with them. Not always congress of a lofty, intellectual sort, where Felody is concerned.
He stopped speaking. I did not ask if he had ever been victim of that sort of attention. He stood up abruptly and walked across the room, speaking over his shoulder.
Up one more set of stairs, and you emerge onto the roof, and the old harem quarters that are now the cells where recalcitrant whites are held.
He drifted away from our work.
Perhaps Prilkop is held there now, or whatever is left of him.
He drew a sudden, deep breath. Then Amber spoke.
It's stuffy in here. Please summon Spark for me. I wish to go out and take the air.
I did as she asked. My sessions with the fool were brief and intermittent. I listened far more than I spoke, and if he silently rose and became Amber and left the room, I let him go. In his absence, I sketched and noted down key bits of information. I valued what he had shared, but I needed more. He had no recent information on their vices or foibles, no names of lovers or enemies, no idea of daily routines. That I would learn by spying when I reached Clara's. There was no rush. Haste would not bring B back. This would be a cold and carefully calculated vengeance. When I struck, I would do so with thoroughness. It would be sweet, I thought, if they died knowing for what crime they suffered. But if they did not, they would still be just as dead. Perforce, my plans were simplistic. My strategy sparse. I arranged my supplies and pondered possibilities. 5 of Shade's exploding pots had survived the bear's attack. One was cracked and leaking a coarse black powder. I softened candle wax and repaired it. I had knives and my old sling, an axe too large to carry in a peaceful city. I doubted those weapons would be useful. I had powdered poisons for mixing with food and some for dusting a surface, oils that could go on a doorknob or the lip of a mug, tasteless liquids and pellets, every form of poison I knew. The bear attack had robbed me of the ones I had carried in quantity. I had no hope of poisoning the castle's water supply or dosing a large kettle of food. I had enough poison to deploy if I could get the 4 to sit down and play dice with me. I doubted such an opportunity would exist, but if I could gain access to their personal lodgings, I could make an end of them. On the bedside table, in the little cups that represented the towers, I arranged 4 black stones. I was holding the 5th in my hand, pondering, when Purr and Spark came in with Lady Amber and Lant.
"Is it a game?"
Purr asked, staring in consternation at the cluttered tables and my murder kit arrayed neatly on the floor.
"If assassination is a game,"
Spark said quietly. She came to stand at my elbow.
"What do the black stones represent?"
"Shade's pots."
"What do they do?"
Purr asked. "They blast things, like trapped sap popping in a firewood log." I gestured at the 5 little pots.
"Only more powerful," the fool said.
"Much more," Spark said quietly.
"I tested some with Shade. When he was healthy, we blew a great hole in a stone cliff near the rock. Rock chips flew everywhere."
She touched her cheek as if remembering a stinging splinter.
"Good,"
the fool said. He took a seat at the table. Amber was long gone as his fingers danced over the carefully arranged items.
"A fire pot for each tower?"
"It might work. The placement of the pots and the strength of the tower walls are key. The pots must be high enough in the tower to make the tower collapse while the 4 are abed. The pots have to explode simultaneously, so I need fuses of different lengths, so I can place and light a pot and then go on to the next until all 4 are burning."
"And still give you time to escape,"
Lant suggested. "That would be very nice, yes." I didn't consider it likely that the pots would explode simultaneously. "I need something to make fuses from." Spark frowned.
"Are not the fuses still in the top of the pots?"
I stared at her.
"What?" "Give me one, please."
With reluctance, I lifted the repaired pot and handed it to her. She scowled at that.
"I'm not sure you should even try to use this one."
She tugged the cap off the pot, and I saw that it had been held on with a thick resin. Inside were 2 coiled strings. One was blue and the other white. She teased them out. The blue was twice the length of the white.
"The blue is longer and burns more slowly. The white burns fast."
"How fast?" She shrugged.
"The white one, set fire to it and run. It is good if you are being chased. The blue one, you can conceal, and then finish your wine and bid your host farewell and be safely out the door."
Lant leaned over my shoulder. I heard the smile in his voice.
"Far easier to use those with 2 of us. One man can never set all 4 and still be away before they explode." "3 of us,"
Spark insisted. I stared at her. Her expression became indignant.
"I've more experience with them than anyone here."
4, Purr said. I wondered if he understood we were talking about murder. It was my fault they included themselves at all. A younger and more energetic Fitz would have kept his plans concealed. I was older and weary, and they already knew too much. Dangerously too much, for them and for me. I wondered if I'd have any secrets left when I died. "When the time comes, we will see," I told them, knowing they would argue if I simply said no.
"I won't see,"
the fool interjected into the silence. For a moment there was discomfort, and then Purr laughed awkwardly. We joined in, more bitter than merry, but still alive, and still moving toward our murderous goal. Chapter 9. The Tarman.
Even before King Shrewd rather unwisely chose to strictly limit skill instruction to the members of the royal family only, the magic was falling into disuse. When I was in my 22nd year, a blood cough swept through all the coastal duchies. The young and the old were carried off in droves. Many aged skill users died in that plague, and with them died their knowledge of the magic. When Prince Regal found that scrolls about skill magic commanded a high price from foreign traders, he began secretly to deplete the libraries of Buckkeep. Did he know that those precious scrolls would ultimately fall into the hands of the Pale Woman and the Red Ship Raiders? That is a matter that has long been debated among Buck nobility, and as Regal has been dead and gone for many years, it is likely we shall never know the truth about that.
On the decline of knowledge of skill during the reign of King Shrewd, Shade Fullstar. We trooped down together to the dock to watch the Tarman arrive in Kelsingra. I had grown up in Buckkeep Town, where the docks were of heavy black timbers, redolent of tar. Those docks seemed to have stood since El brought the sea to our shores. This dock was recently built, of pale planks with some pilings of stone and some raw timber. New construction had been fastened to the ancient remains of an elderling dock. I pondered that, for I did not judge this the best location for a dock. The half-devoured buildings at the river's edge told me that the river often shifted in its bed. The new elderlings of Kelsingra needed to lift their eyes from what had been and consider the river and the city as they were now. Above the broken cliffs that backed the city, on the highest hills, the snow had slumped into thin, random fingers. In the distance, I could see the birches blushing pink and the willows gone red at the tips of their branches. The wind off the river was wet and cold, but the knife's edge of winter was gone from it. The year was turning, and with it, the direction of my life. A sprinkling rain fell as the Tarman approached. Motley clung to Perseverance's shoulder, her head tucked tight against the rain. Lance stood behind him. Spark stood next to Amber. We clustered near enough to watch and far enough back that we were not in the way. Amber's gloved hand rested on my wrist. I spoke to her in a low voice. The river runs swift and deep and doubtless cold. It is pale grey with silt and smells sour. Once there was more shore here. Over decades, the river has eaten its way into Kelsingra. There are two other ships docked here. They both appear idle. The Tarman is a river barge, sweeps oars long and low to the water. One powerful woman is on the steering oar. The ship has travelled upriver on the far side of the river, and now it's crossed the current, turned back, and is moving with the current. No figurehead. I was disappointed. I'd heard that the figureheads on live ships could move and speak. It has eyes painted on the hull, and it's coming fast with the current, and two deckhands have joined the steerswoman on the rudder. The crew is battling the current to bring the ship in here. As the Tarman neared and its lines were tossed to folk on the dock, where they were caught and snubbed off around the cleats, the barge reared like a willful horse and water piled up against its stern. There was something odd about the way the barge fought the current, but I could not place it. Water churned all around it, lines and dock timbers creaked as they took its weight. Some lines were tightened, and others loosened until the captain was satisfied that his craft was well snugged to the dock. The longshoremen were waiting with their barrows, and one tall elderling on the dock was grinning in the way that only a man hoping to see his sweetheart grins. Alum. That was his name. I watched the deck and soon spotted her. She was in constant motion, relaying commands and helping to make the Tarman fast to the dock, but twice I caught her eyes roving over the welcoming crowd. When she saw her elderling sweetheart, her face lit, and she seemed to move even more efficiently as if to flaunt her prowess. A gangplank was thrown down, and about a dozen passengers disembarked, their possessions in bags or packs. The immigrants came ashore uncertainly, staring up in wonder or perhaps dismay at the half-ruined city. I wondered what they had imagined, and if they would stay. On a separate gangplank, the longshoremen began to come and go like a line of ants as the ship disgorged cargo.
"That's the boat we'll travel on?"
Spark asked doubtfully.
"That's the one."
"I've never been on a boat."
"I've been out in little boats before. Rowboats on the Withy. Nothing like that."
Perseverance's eyes roved over the tarman. His mouth was slightly ajar. I could not tell if he was anxious or eager.
"You'll be fine," Lant assured them. "Look how stable that ship is, and we're only going to be on a river, not the sea."
I noted to myself that Lant was speaking to the youngsters more as if they were his younger siblings than his servants.
"Do you see the captain?"
I responded to Amber's question. "I see a man past his middle years approaching Rain. He has been larger in his life, I think, but looks gaunt now." They greet each other fondly. I suspect that is Leftrin, and the woman with him would be Elise. She has a great deal of very curly, reddish hair. Amber had shared with me the scandalous tale of how Elise had forsaken her legal but unfaithful Bingtown husband to take up with the captain of a live ship. They are both exclaiming over Fron. They look delighted. Her hand tightened slightly on my arm as she fastened a smile onto her face. "Here they come," I added quietly. Lant stepped up beside me. Behind me, Purr and Spark fell silent. We waited. A smiling Rain introduced us.
"And here are our six Duchy's visitors, Captain Leftrin and Elise of the liveship Tarman. May I present Prince Fitzchivalry Farcia, Lady Amber, and Lord Lant of the six Duchy's."
Lant and I bowed, and Amber fell and rose in a graceful curtsy. Leftrin sketched a startled bow, and Elise deployed a respectable curtsy before rising to stare at me in consternation. A smile passed over her face before she seemed to recall her manners.
"We are pleased to offer you passage on Tarman to Treehog. Malta and Rhaen have told us that Efron's renewed health is due to your magic."
"Thank you."
"We have no children of our own, and Efron has been as dear to us as he is to his parents."
Captain Leftrin nodded gravely.
"As the lady says," he added gruffly, "give us a day or so to get our cargo on the beach. Give our crew a bit of shore time, and we'll be ready to carry you down river. Quarters on Tarman are not spacious. We'll do our best to make you comfortable, but I'm sure it won't be the sort of travel a prince is used to, nor a lord and a lady."
"I am sure we will be most content with whatever you offer us. Our goal is not comfort, but transport," I replied.
"And that Tarman can provide, swifter and better than any on this river."
He spoke with the pride of a captain who owns his ship.
"We'd be pleased to welcome you aboard now and show you the quarters we've readied for you."
"We would be delighted," Amber replied warmly.
"This way, please."
We followed them onto the dock and up the gangplank. The way was narrow, and I worried that Amber might make a misstep, but as I stepped onto the barge's deck, that worry was replaced with a new one. The live ship resonated against both my wit and my skill. A live ship indeed, as alive as any moving and breathing creature I'd ever known. I was certain the Tarman was as aware of me as I was of him. Lant was looking around with a wide grin on his face, as pleased as a boy on an adventure, and Purr echoed him. Motley had lifted herself from the boy's shoulder and circled the barge suspiciously, flapping hard to keep her place against the river wind. Spark was more reserved than Lant and Purr, almost wary. Amber put her hand back on my arm as soon as she could and gripped it tightly. Elise stepped onto the ship, followed by Leftrin. Both halted, as abruptly as if encountering a wall.
"Oh my,"
Elise said softly.
"A little more than that,"
Leftrin said tightly. He froze, and the communication between him and his ship was like a plucked string thrumming. He fixed me with a stare.
"My ship is... I must ask, are you claimed by a dragon?"
We both stiffened. Had the ship sensed the dragon blood she had consumed? She let go of my arm and stood alone, ready to let any blame fall on herself.
I think what your ship senses about me is actually...
Beg pardon, ma'am. It's not you unsettling my ship.
It's him.
Me? Even to myself, I sounded foolishly startled.
You?
Leftrin confirmed. His mouth was pinched. He glanced at Elise.
My dear, perhaps you could show the ladies their quarters while I settle this.
Elise's eyes were very large.
Of course I could.
And I knew that she was helping him separate me from my companions, though I could not guess why. I turned to my tiny retinue. Spark, if you would guide your mistress while I have a word with the captain. Lant and Purr, you will excuse us. Spark registered the unspoken warning and swiftly claimed Amber's arm. Lant and Perseverance had already moved down the deck, examining the ship as they went.
Tell me all about the ship, Spark,
Amber requested in an unconcerned voice. They moved off slowly, following Elise, and I heard the girl adding descriptions to everything Elise said to them. I turned back to Leftrin. Your ship dislikes me? I asked. I was not reading that from my sense of the Tarman, but I'd never been aboard a live ship before.
No, my ship wants to speak with you.
Leftrin crossed his arms on his barrel chest, then seemed to realize how unfriendly that appeared. He loosened his arms and wiped his hands down his trouser legs.
Come on up to the bow rail. He talks best there.
He walked ponderously, and I followed slowly. He spoke over his shoulder to me.
Tarman talks to me, he said. Sometimes to Elise. Maybe to Hennessy. Sometimes to the others in dreams and such. I don't ask, and he doesn't tell me. He's not like other live ships. He's more his own than... Well, you wouldn't understand. You aren't trader stock. Let me just say this. Tarman has never asked to speak to a stranger. I don't know what he's about, but understand that what he says goes. The Keeper's made a deal with you, but if he says he doesn't want you on his deck, that's it.
He drew a breath.
Sorry,
he added. I understand, I said, but I didn't. As I moved toward the bow, my sense of the Tarman became more acute and uncomfortable. It was like being sniffed over by a dog, a large and unpredictable dog with bared teeth. I repressed my impulse to show my own teeth or display aggression in any way. His presence pressed more strongly against my walls. I allow this, I pointed out to him as he pushed his senses into my mind. As if you have the right to refuse. You tread my deck, and I will know you. What dragon has touched you? Under the circumstances, lying would have been foolish. A dragon pushed into my dreams. I think it was a dragon named Sintara, who claims the elderling Timara. I have been close to the dragons Tintaglia and Hebe. Perhaps that is what you sense. No, you smell of a dragon I have never sensed. Come closer. Put your hands on the railing. I looked at the railing. Captain Leftrin was staring stonily across the river. I could not tell if he was aware of what his ship said to me or not. He wants me to put my hands on the railing.
Then I suggest you do so,
he responded gruffly. I looked at it. The wood was grey and fine-grained and unfamiliar to me. I drew off my gloves and placed my hands on the railing. There. I knew I smelled him. You touched him with your hands, didn't you? You... groomed him. I have never groomed a dragon. You did, and he claims you as his. Verity. It was not a thought I had intended to share. My walls were slipping before this ship's determination to force his way into my mind. I set my boundaries tighter, trying to work subtly so the ship would not perceive I was blocking him, but wonder had set my blood to racing. Would dragons of flesh and blood truly count Verity as a dragon who could claim me? I dusted the leaves from his back. Was that the grooming that this ship had sensed? And if dragons could consider Verity a dragon, then did this barge count himself as a dragon? The ship was silent, considering. Then, yes, that dragon, he claims you. Overhead, Motley cawed loudly. The hardest thing in the world is to think of nothing. I considered the pattern of the wind and the current on the river's face. I longed to reach for Verity with a desire that almost surpassed my need to breathe, to touch that cold stone with my mind and heart, to feel that in some sense he guarded my back. The ship broke into my thoughts. He claims you. Do you deny it? I am his. I was startled to find that was still true. I have been his for a very long time. As if a human knows what a very long time is. But I accept you as his. As Leftrin and Elise wish it, I will carry you to Treehog. But it is your will that you do this. I am not interfering with a human claimed by a dragon. I wondered what it meant that a live ship accepted me and believed that a stone dragon had claimed me. I wondered how Verity had marked me as his own. Had he known he had done it? A dozen questions sprang to my mind, but Tarman had dismissed me. It was like a door closing on a noisy tavern, leaving me in dark and quiet. I felt both wild relief at how alone I was, and a sense of loss for things he could have told me. I reached, but could not sense Tarman at all. Captain Leftrin knew it at the same moment I did. For a moment, he stared at me, taking my measure. Then he grinned.
He's done with you. Want to see where you'll be bunking for the trip downriver?
Yes, please. The change in his demeanour was as abrupt as the sun emerging from a cloudbank on a blustery day. He led me aft, past the ship's deckhouse to two blocky structures attached to the deck.
These are a lot nicer now than the first time we used them. Never thought Tarman would be ferrying as many people as he carries crates of freight. But times change, and we change with them. Slowly, and sometimes without a lot of grace. But even a rain wilder can change. This one is for you, Lord Lant, and your boy.
He looked uncomfortable for a moment.
It would be better if you and your lady had private quarters, but where would I put your serving girl? Shoreside, girls don't seem happy to share the crew quarters, even though on my ship there's no danger to them, just no privacy. We've given the other cabin to the women. I'm sure it's a lot less than what a prince expects, but it's the best we can offer.
Transport is all we desire, and I'd be happy to sleep out on the deck. It wouldn't be the first time in my life.
Ah. The man visibly relaxed. Well, hearing that will ease Elise's worries. She's been so anxious since we got the word we were going to give you passage. A prince from the Six Duchies. What will we feed him? Where will he sleep? On and on. That's my Elise, always wanting to do things in the best possible way.
He opened the door.
Was a time when these cabins weren't much more than cargo crates, built big. But we've had close to a score of years to make them comfortable. The others ain't been here yet, I don't think, so you can claim the bunk you want.
Folk who live aboard ships know how to make the best of a small space. I had braced myself for the smell of old laundry, for canvas hammocks and a splintery floor. Two small windows admitted daylight, and it danced on gleaming yellow woodwork. Four bunks, stacked too high, none spacious, lined two of the walls. The room smelled pleasantly of the oil that had been used to wipe down the wood. One wall was all cupboards, drawers and crannies, framed around the little window. A pair of blue curtains had been pushed back from the open window to admit both light and air. A more pleasant little water cottage I could not imagine. I told the captain, and turned to find Elise at his elbow, beaming with pleasure at my words. Lant and Perseverance stood behind her. The lad's cheeks were bright red with the wind, and his eyes shone. His grin widened as he peered into our cabin.
"The ladies were pleased with theirs as well,"
Elise observed happily.